Welcome, everyone. It is good to see you tonight. Today marks a momentous occasion in our journey together this year. Tonight, we transition from the Old Testament into the New. We also transition into not just going into the New Testament, but the second part of the grand thesis for this whole study, and I'll get to that later. Last week, we ended on the songs of Isaiah, and I made the case then that the servant that Isaiah talks about in chapters 40 through 55, that section of his book, is intended by Isaiah to be the idealized Israel, sort of personified, that this person has the same vocation as an individual that Israel as a nation has to bless the nations, to reveal to the nations God's goodness, God's justice, God's glory, but that this servant fails, Israel fails, and that God then uses that person's suffering as he is using the nation's suffering to bring about an even greater redemption. And I argued at the time that that was basically the prophet's attempt at wrestling through the implications of the destruction of the kingdom. Because behind the kingdom, of course, are all these grand promises. God's promise to Abraham that his descendants would bless the nation. Well, now Israel has defamed God and is a scourge to the nations. That God would reveal to the nations his law, his wisdom, that Israel has mocked God's law. They're disobedient, unfaithful to God, that they haven't done that. That the God would install a king, an heir of David, on David's throne forever. Well, now the city of Jerusalem's in ruins and the people are in exile. How do we wrestle with these things? How do we talk about the goodness of God, the grandeur of God, the sovereignty of God, in short, the godness of God, if his words fail? And so Isaiah, is part of his answer is to see in Israel's rejection, in Israel's exile, in Israel's suffering, the atonement which not only blesses Israel, but also blesses all the nations. You remember that second song where the servant has said that it's too light a thing to just save Israel, that they have to save all of the nations as well. And so that's really Israel's first awareness as a nation through the ministry of the prophet Isaiah, that something more is afoot in their national calling, their national election by God, you might say, than merely to have a little kingdom in ancient Palestine and have a strong monarchy. There's a lot more going on in their case. And some of this we will already have hinted at earlier in this lesson, earlier in this series, but I'll bring those things back to your attention if it's not clear what I'm talking about. So sure enough, Isaiah is ministering in the 8th century, about 100 years or so later. The southern kingdom does indeed fall to Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians. And the exile that was promised all the way back by Moses in Deuteronomy, that's reiterated by the prophet Amos, who prophesies to the northern kingdom in the 9th century BC, that the people are going to go into exile. And this was actually fairly standard political treatment of conquered peoples. See, one of the ways that you would pacify a realm was by deporting all of its elite. You know, you would take their educated elites, you know, magistrates and judges, their clergy, certainly any members of the governing body, the royal household. You'd take all those people away and you'd leave in the land all of the peasantry and the lower classes. And that's how you would impose on a society that's been conquered your sovereignty over them, how you pacify resistance. And this policy actually continues into the modern day. I mean, when the Soviets took over Russia, one of their targets was the intelligentsia and the bourgeoisie, the merchant classes and the elites, the old aristocracy of Russia, to get them out of the way. They either fled in exile or they were executed, rounded up and executed. That's one of the great ways to install a new ideology, is to get rid of all the people in a place that might object and might have a platform for objecting, either because they're educated or because they're attached to an old aristocracy of some kind. And so this is not terribly new idea, that this is how you do it. And all of the major empires of this age did it this way. So when the Assyrians did it to the northern tribes, it's what they did. They left just the poor in the land. Some of those people in the north did happen to flee to the south and were refugees down there for another 100 years. And then this is what the Babylonians did to both the Assyrians and then to the Judahites, is they took away all of their elite. Now, Nebuchadnezzar actually succeeded in conquering Jerusalem twice. He did it once in the year 597, and he did not destroy the city at that time. He just took away the city's elite, just like I described to you. He took all their priests, he took the young children away, and educated them in Babylonian universities. Some of the major players that were involved in this deportation were the prophets Daniel and Ezekiel. Daniel is taken as a young boy. He's a member of the upper classes. And it's interesting, Nebuchadnezzar's philosophy of repatriation, he puts Daniel, along with all the other Jewish children, into his own academies and teaches them the literature of the Babylonians. And the idea there is to displace their own cultural heritage with the Babylonian heritage and to make them Babylonian. And they even give them new names. And he's a prophet Ezekiel, who's a member of the ruling priestly class, is also taken at that time as well. And most of his visions are actually given in Babylon. And so he prophesies the temple is going to fall. And 10 years later, it does. In 586, Nebuchadnezzar invades Judah again. The kings have rebelled against his overlordship. And Nebuchadnezzar's had enough of the Judahites. I think this is now the second or third time he's had to pacify them. It's certainly the second time he's had to besiege the capital. And so this time he doesn't leave anybody. He just destroys the whole city and destroys the temple and kicks everybody out. And that's the moment when the kingdom ends, the line of David ends. The last king of Judah is actually, he has his eyes gouged out and watched his sons killed before him before that happens. You know, Nebuchadnezzar's not messing around this time. And so the kingdom's over. And the Jewish people who are now living in exile in Assyria and Babylon and other parts, if they've escaped to Egypt, you know, Jeremiah escaped with a crew to Egypt. So they're kind of around now, but they're definitely scattered out of the Holy Land. They begin to really start asking serious questions about what happened to them. And they start wrestling with the law of Moses. They start wrestling with the prophets and the writings that they left behind. And they begin to wonder about what their future is. Now, what's remarkable about the Jewish people is that of all the many, many types of peoples that were subject to these kinds of policies at this time, you know, deported to a new place, the Jews rather uniquely managed to preserve a discrete sense of themselves as a nation. And we don't really know of anybody else that did that the way that they did. Part of that is because they had this controlling literature. They had the scriptures. At this point, the bulk of the Old Testament canon has now been committed to writing. We know they're reading the prophets because some of the prophets quote other prophets. Zechariah, for example, who's an exilic prophet, quotes the prophet Isaiah, quotes the prophet Jeremiah. So we know they're reading these guys and that they're wrestling with what they have to say and what it means. At the heart of the Jewish identity is, of course, the temple system and the sacrificial system of the priesthood. And it's a major problem if we're going to recommit ourselves to fidelity to the law of Moses, because we've been sinful, and now we've got to recommit, when a big chunk of that law deals with a system that we no longer have access to. The temple's been destroyed. So what do we do? And so the beginning of an idea is fledgling at this time, which now is dominates modern Judaism, that we can satisfy the sacrifices of the temple in the temple's absence by rigorous study of Torah, by engaging in study of the Hebrew scripture. And that's how the synagogue gets formed, you know, these local gatherings of Jews in a place. They gather around the reading of Torah, and they just study Torah, and they read it, and they sing it, and they chant it. And that actual service gathered around a written word forms the basis of the Christian service of the word. The first half of our Eucharistic service is basically descended from the synagogue worship that's fledgling at this time. So just quickly recapping what happens now. I mean, Prophet Jeremiah had prophesied that 70 years would pass. And so around the 70-year mark, the prophet Daniel is sort of checking his calendar and realizes that the day is almost upon them. And so he starts vigorously praying to God to remember his people, to remember the city that bears his name, and not for our sakes because we're sinful, but because the city bears your name, let us go back. And you wonder if he's not channeling an inner Ezekiel here, and God says, not for your sake, but for my honor's sake, I will redeem you. And God responds very favorably to Daniel's prayer. The Babylonian Empire itself falls fairly quickly, within three generations after Nebuchadnezzar, three short reigns after him, to the Medo-Persian Empire, which is sort of on the fringes of the Babylonian Empire when they are at their height. And the Medo-Persians come in under a guy named Cyrus, who manages to conquer Babylon and subjugate the entire realm that Babylon controlled to his power. And he sacks the city of Babylon itself without a fight. And he does that because the Euphrates River flows right through the center of Babylon, and the whole city's got walls around it except for where the river flows around it. And the river's a large river, so it's not really a strategic risk to have that part unwalled, unless Cyrus gets his engineers to re-divert the river upstream, which he manages to actually do. And so the Persian army walks into Babylon on the dry riverbed of the Euphrates. No walls, no resistance of any kind. Scholars also think there was some discontent among the Babylonian aristocracy with the king, and so they kind of maybe lended Cyrus some aid. Cyrus gets into power in Babylon. He's got all these peoples now under his authority, including all of these peoples that have been exiled by Assyrian and Babylonian policies before him. And he thinks to himself, like, you know, this policy of pacifying conquered peoples by taking all of their elites and moving them halfway across the world hasn't exactly worked out very well. Of course, Assyria falls to Babylon quickly. Babylon falls to the Persians quickly. Like, it's not actually creating stability. And so Cyrus has this great idea. What if we actually allow the local people to preserve their religions and their customs? And we put our governors over them, and they pay taxes to us. You know, we put armies there. But let's not oppress them. Let's leave them where they are and let them continue doing what they do. They're going to be thankful to us for that, and they're going to be more compliant. And so Cyrus issues this extraordinary decree that has survived. There's actually a copy of it which has survived in a clay cylinder that's in Akkadian cuneiform. That's in the British Museum now, I think, which corroborates this edict, the truth of this edict, basically calling for the repatriation of all exiled peoples under his authority and for the redevelopment of their local religious cults. And he does this for all of the exiled peoples under his control, not just the Jews, but for everybody. And this marks the moment when exiled Jews are allowed to go back to the Holy Land and rebuild their life together. Remarkably, so far as we're able to reconstruct, the Jewish people don't go back in large numbers. Why do you suppose they wouldn't have gone back? There's nothing to go back to. I mean, Judah's been destroyed. There's nothing there. I mean, all the cities have been, they're rubble. And of course, in the intervening 70 years, people like Daniel, for example, have actually made quite a name for themselves among the cities where they find themselves. They've made lives for themselves. They've, you know, married and had children and had grandchildren. So they don't want to leave. They're comfortable. And so it starts as a trickle, and it actually starts accelerating only later. Around the year 520 or so, so this is now almost 20 years after Cyrus gives his edict in 538, a man named Zerubbabel, a Jewish descendant of David, asks for permission to go back to Palestine and rebuild the Jewish temple. And he actually receives permission from another Persian successor to Cyrus, a guy named Darius, who's actually eager for this to happen. And so he endues Zerubbabel with authority, makes him the governor of the province of Judea, which is now a Persian province, and sends him back with around 40,000 exiles to go and rebuild Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. And Zerubbabel gets on that fairly quickly. There's some resistance from the locals. In the New Testament, we know that the Jews and the Samaritans don't get along with each other very well. There's a lot of hostility there. Scholars aren't 100% sure, but we think the Samaritans descend from some of the people who stayed behind, and they intermarried with some of the, you know, people that were brought in to repopulate the territory. And so they're like half Jew, half not. And they ask if they can help participate in rebuilding the temple. Zerubbabel says no, because they're not fully Jewish. And then they resist by writing letters and getting the project stopped and, you know, whatever. Zerubbabel does eventually prevail in building the temple again. And there are actually some survivors alive at that time who are back in Jerusalem who remember Solomon's temple. And they look at Zerubbabel's temple and they weep because it just can't compare to the glory that they once knew. And so even at the end of that long decline of the monarchy, the Temple of Solomon was still an extraordinary edifice to behold. Zerubbabel's temple and the temples which succeed it are known by scholars as the Second Temple, with Solomon's temple being the first temple. And so every once in a while, you'll hear me refer in the coming weeks to Second Temple Judaism. That's a reference to Judaism as reconstituted in the land after the exile. And so there is the Levitic priesthood is reestablished. Zerubbabel is the heir of David, but he's just a Persian governor. And that temple is completed around the year 518. There's a second major wave almost, 70 years later, 458, under a man named Ezra. And according to the biblical account, remarkably, Ezra is sent by the Persian king to teach Israel the law. You know, because Ezra is a priest, and he wants the Israelites to be faithful to their religion. You know, this is part of his policy of keeping them at bay. So he sends Ezra to go and educate them about what the law says. So Ezra goes, and he finds the city is in chaos, and the temple's discipline has grown lax. And so Ezra begins a project of trying to bring about a reformation with the people by preaching the word, by reading it publicly and preaching it. We heard in that reading we read today that they read the Torah out loud for a quarter of the day. Can you imagine going to church and just hearing the Bible being read for that length of time? That's Ezra's program for reform. Following on the heels of Ezra and the group that Ezra brings is another guy named Nehemiah, who's not a Levite. He's a Jew, and he's also made a royal governor of the Persian province of Palestine, or Judea. And he arrives after requesting to rebuild the city walls of Jerusalem. And the Persian emperor grants this, says, go ahead and rebuild it. And so Nehemiah shows up, and together Nehemiah and Ezra kind of are a tag team that help get everything, help call the people back to repentance and get the temple establishment sort of restarted. So we read it today from Nehemiah chapter 9, and the Levites are leading the people in a sort of corporate confession of sin for all of what's happened to them. And there's a number of remarkable things happening in this passage that I just want to call your attention to. They start by praising God as the creator. You are the Lord, you alone. This is verse 6 of chapter 9. You alone made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their hosts, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve all of them, and the host of heaven worships you. You are the Lord. They go right back to Genesis 1. This is just where the story starts, right? I mean, they're starting to tell the story. God creates everything. God alone is God. There's no other gods besides him. He creates all that is. He preserves all that is. And then the next part of the story after the creation, moving past the flood, you know, what happens in the story after that? He chooses Abram, which is where the Levites go next. You are the Lord, the God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham. You found his heart faithful before him and made before you and made with him a covenant to give to his offspring the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, and the Girgashite. And you have kept your promise, for you are righteous. So the next stage of the story is Abraham, and they revisit that. What happens after Abraham? Where do the descendants of Abraham end up? In Egypt. What happens to them there? They're enslaved. Well, that's interestingly enough where the Levites go next. And you saw the affliction of our fathers in Egypt and heard their cry at the Red Sea, and performed signs and wonders against Pharaoh and all his servants and all the people of his land. For you knew that they acted arrogantly against our fathers, and you made a name for yourself as it is to this day. What a remarkable statement of faith. You made a name for yourself way back then. From the perspective of the Levites, let's see, this is 450 roughly. Best guess put the Exodus sometime around 1400 BC, depending on how you crunch the numbers. So this is 1,000 years later, right? 1,000 years of history has passed. That's us and the Norman conquest of England, 1066, right? Like a lot of time has passed, and they're still saying that God's name that he made for himself then endures to this day. And you divided the sea before them so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and you cast their pursuers into the depths as a stone into mighty waters. By a pillar of cloud you led them in all in the day, and by a pillar of fire in the night to light for them the way in which they should go. You came down on Mount Sinai and spoke with them from heaven and gave them right rules and true laws, good statutes and commandments. And you have made known to them your holy Sabbath and commanded them commandments and statutes and a law by Moses your servant. You gave them bread from heaven for their hunger and brought water from them out of the rock for their thirst. And you told them to go in to possess the land that you had sworn to give them. This is the summary of the book of Exodus, right? I mean, this is the next part in the story, is Israel's exodus out of the land and the giving of the law at Sinai. Well, what happens to Israel after they leave Egypt and get the law at Sinai? They mess up. Remember the name of that mess up? Golden Calf Gate, right? They worship, they build for themselves a new God, and this is the God who brought you out of the realm of Egypt. Well, that's where the Levites go next. But they and our fathers acted presumptuously and stiffened their neck and did not obey your commandments. They refused to obey and were not mindful of the wonders that you had performed among them. But they stiffened their neck and appointed a leader to return to their slavery in Egypt. I assume that's Aaron. I'm not sure who they'd be referring to there. It's got to be Aaron because he's the one who made for them that calf. But you are a God ready to forgive, gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and to not forsake them. That's what God says to Moses when Moses is trying to pacify God after this event. You remember that? And God, you know, God says, Moses has to see God's face, and Moses says, God says, no, I can't do that, but I can show you my back. And then God says, the Lord, merciful, full of mercy and abounding in love. This is just recapitulating that story. I mean, they're just reading the story. God continues to provide for them. He continues to provide for them in the wilderness with a pillar of cloud and fire. He gave them their spirit to instruct them, gave them food. And then you gave them kingdoms and peoples and allotted to them every corner, verse 22. So that they took possession of the land of Sihon, king of Heshbon, and the land of Og, king of Bashan. This is in Numbers 21. You multiplied their children as the stars of the heaven, and you brought them into the land that you had told their fathers to enter and possess. So the descendants went in and possessed the land, and he subdued before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and etc. This is God's great blessing to them. You know, he's given them the land. We've now made our way into Joshua. Starting in verse 26, nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against you and cast your law behind their back and killed your prophets who had warned them in order to turn them back to you and they committed great blasphemies. Therefore, you gave them into the hand of their enemies who made them suffer. And in the time of their suffering, they cried out to you and you heard them from heaven. And according to your great mercies, you gave them saviors who saved them from the land of their enemies. Who's this referring to? Who are the saviors that God raised up for Israelites when they cried out? The judges. And how does the period of the judges end? With the kings, with the monarchy, right? I mean, Saul's raised up to defeat the Philistines. And David finishes the job. So this is all kind of encompassed all in all of that, that God raises up these people. Yet when they turned and cried to you, heard them, delivered them according to your mercies, and you warned them in order to turn them back to your law. Yet they acted presumptuously. There's that second time that word's been used. And did not obey your commandments, but sinned against your rules, which if a person does them, he shall live by them. And they turned a stubborn shoulder and stiffened their neck and would not obey. Many years you bore with them and warned them by your spirit through your prophets, yet they would not give ear. Therefore you gave them into the hand of the peoples of the lands. Nevertheless, in your great mercy, you did not make an end of them or forsake them, for you are a gracious and merciful God. What's he talking about here? What are they summarizing here? The exile. It's remarkable that all the national calamities that they've experienced, the destruction of their kingdom and the end of their royal line, these Levites can still point to the fact, but you did not put an end to them. We're still here. Isn't that amazing? After all that we've suffered, we're still alive. You know, we still endure. Now therefore, our God, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love, let not all the hardships seem little to you that has come upon us, upon our kings, our princes, our priests, and our prophets, and our fathers, and all your people since the time of kings of Assyria until this day. You have been righteous in all, and all that has come upon us, for you have dealt faithfully, and we have acted wickedly. God's innocent. He warned them, he gave them a law, he gave them prophets, he gave them saviors, he gave them signs, he gave them wonders, he gave them provision, he gave them the land that he told them he would give them. He's off the hook. He's not responsible for what's happened. They are guilty. Even in their own kingdom and amidst their great goodness that you gave them and in the large and rich land that you set before them, they did not serve you and turn from their wicked ways. And then something remarkable is said. You know, keeping in mind, this sermon, this exhortation is being preached to the Jews in Jerusalem, right? So they're back. They've come back from exile. The 70 years that Jeremiah the prophet predicts have passed, have elapsed, or finished. So they're home, right? And they've got the temple rebuilt, and they've got the sacrifices going again, and they've got this Zerubbabel guy who's an heir of David, sort of ruling. He's not a king, but, you know, he's in charge. And they've been triumphant over their enemies. They've overcome attempts against their whole existence. You know, think about Esther and the program against the Jews initiated by Nahum. They're back. It should be over, right? I mean, this is all the prophetic hopes that they would be restored and God would bring them back and a new age would dawn. I think even back in the Holy Land, they realize this isn't it. This isn't what Isaiah prophesied. This isn't what Ezekiel prophesied. This is what Jeremiah prophesied. We're still in our sins. We're still living under foreign overlords. So they say, behold, verse 36, we are slaves this day. And the land that you gave to our fathers to enjoy its fruit and its good gifts, behold, we are slaves. We're here. We're in the land. We've got the temple. We've got the sacrifices. We've got the Torah. And we're slaves because we live under the overlordship of other people. Right? And so they ask God to have mercy on them, and they renew a covenant with God to be faithful to him. This is what's going on. This is the reform that I was telling you about. Ezra and Nehemiah are leading, and how they're wrestling with the circumstances of their national history and the calamities that have fallen upon them. And in this remarkable confession, they run through the whole story, starting in creation with Genesis, we're right where we started, and they walk through it with a keen sobriety. You're righteous, we're guilty. You know, everything that we had coming to us that you promised would happen, happened because we didn't obey. And now we're slaves this day. We're slaves. You know, I argued with you as we were walking our way through the prophets, Ezekiel and Jeremiah especially, that the prophets themselves at least, are coming to an awareness of the fact that Israel's problem is not at the end of the day that Babylon is stronger than they are. That's not what's wrong. You ask a political analyst from the Cato Institute or whatever, to like, well, tell us what's going on. It's not because Babylon's better at foreign policy. It's not because their armies are stronger. It's not Israel's problem. They're not slaves to the Babylonians because the Babylonians beat them, right? They're slaves to a far more pernicious enemy. They're slaves to sin. They can't not sin. They can't obey God, right? So something has to give, which prompts these grand prophecies by Ezekiel and Jeremiah, right at the end of Judah's existence as a nation, an independent nation, that God's going to have to, it's not enough to bring them back. God's going to have to give them new hearts. They're going to have those hearts of stone taken out that make them stiff-necked and unresponsive to God's word and give them hearts of flesh. He's going to have to resurrect the nation by the power of his Holy Spirit. Nothing else is going to do it. And this also prompts the prophet Isaiah, now writing 100 years before the fact, that it's not enough for them just to be brought back. The sin is going to have to be atoned for somehow. The guilt of the nation is going to have to be put away. Isaiah seems to hint that part of the afflictions of the exile are that expiation. But then Isaiah sees that, well, yeah, but they deserve that. It's going to be something even deeper, that somebody representing the whole nation is going to endure an atoning suffering that's going to finally put away Israel's sins. And even still, not, this is too light a thing for you to save the nations or save Israel, atone for the sins of the whole world. Right? So they're beginning to understand that this is the case. And it's still very dim. You know, they have the prophets, but it's still a little dim. And so the reform goes slowly. You know, Ezra and Nehemiah are successful in their generation, but things don't last that long, you know, faithfully. The book of Malachi, for example, is another prophet writing around the same time, because the Israelites are intermarrying with the locals. I mean, have they not learned that this is not a good idea? I mean, come on. That's what Malachi's about. God says, I hate divorce. Well, who are they divorcing? They're divorcing their Jewish wives and marrying foreign wives. And so God doesn't just hate divorce because he hates divorce, though that's true too. They're doing the same things all over again that caught them in trouble the first time. Fast forward now through the history. This is now 430. So there's 430 years between them and Christ. A lot happens to the Jews during that time. The Persians themselves are finally conquered by Alexander in the year 333, so a little over 100 years after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Alexander moves through Syria and the Levant and conquers it. And Judea as a province passes to his generals after Alexander dies. Dies fairly young, And so Alexander's great empire is divided up among his four generals. And Egypt goes to the general Ptolemy and his heirs, and Syria, based in Antioch, goes to a guy named Seleucid and his heirs. Judea, if you know your geography, is right in between Syria and Egypt. And so Judah goes back and forth for a while between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. They're kind of fighting over it because it's their frontier, right? If they can fortify their frontier, they can protect themselves against their, you know, the enemy. And so Judea is kind of strategically important, and it keeps flip-flopping between the two. And it's not until around middle of the second century, or middle 200s BC, that Judah finally falls under the permanent sway of the Seleucids. But the Jews are a peculiar people. They've been through a lot now as a nation, and they're very keenly aware that they have an election from God and a unique calling in the world to be holy. And even though they don't always live up to it, they've at least learned that at this point. And so they make life difficult for their Greek rulers, who are keen to impose upon them all kinds of Greek customs, you know, Greek plays and Greek worship and Greek dramas and whatever. And the Jews respond with varying degrees of response. You know, some like it, some don't, some reject it. And the Jews start fighting with each other. They start fighting with the Greeks who are ruling them. And so finally, this Seleucid guy named Antiochus IV, still styled himself Epiphanes, which means revelation of God, he decides, I've had enough of these Jews. I'm going to outlaw Judaism, right? It's an interesting approach. He's not killing Jews. He's outlawing Judaism, right? And he builds stuff in Jerusalem that is, you know, a gymnasium and stuff that the Greeks liked. And some of the Jews like this, and some of the Jews don't, and things get really bad. And this is all recounted in the book of Maccabees. If you guys ever wonder what those books are about, 1st and 2nd Maccabees are about Antiochus Epiphanes and his miserable attempt to try and bring the Jews into subjection to himself. And one Jew, a Levite actually, a member of the priestly caste, a guy named Judas Maccabeus, manages to rally the people behind him, and he beats the Greeks. He manages to kick them out of Judea. And for a period of around 100 years, the Judeans actually have independence. And they think, you know, well, maybe this is it. Maybe this is now the moment when, you know, we're independent now for the first time since we were destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe this is our moment. But the Maccabeans don't turn out to be very messianic. You know, they don't usher in an age of righteousness. You know, they become corrupted by wealth and power, and they themselves start becoming like the Greeks over time. And so the Jews start fighting with each other again. And finally, after a while, now the Romans are on the scene, and one party within the Jewish community who's warring against another party in the Jewish community asks the Romans to come in and help them. And that's a bad idea, right? I mean, this is what Ahaz did. You know, ask Tiglath-Pileser to come help. He's not going to stop eating once he's eaten up your northern neighbors. So the Romans come in and they stay. You know, like, we've helped you now, so you owe us. And so it's actually Julius Caesar that elevates the first king of the Herodian dynasty that displaces the Hasmoneans, who the Maccabeans had founded that dynasty. And now the Romans control Palestine, and they have installed in Judea these guys who are kind of Jewish, like they're ethnically Jewish, but they're very, very Romanized, very Hellenized, have adopted all kinds of Greek customs, Greco-Roman customs, and they rule as indigenous kings, but they rule for the Romans. You know, they're paying tribute to Rome, and this initiates a period of back and forth between the local Herodian kings and just direct Roman rule. So when Jesus is born, Herod actually governs Judea. By the time Jesus is an adult, there's actually a Roman governor in Jerusalem, just governing directly. That's Pilate. And so this goes back and forth several times during the life of Jesus. I go through all of this because it's important to stress that the Jewish people have been through a lot now, you know, and they've been kind of waiting for a while. This is now 400 plus years since they were allowed to come back from captivity in Babylon. And life isn't really a whole lot better for them than it was when Ezra and Nehemiah led the people in this prayer, right? They're still slaves. They're still answerable to foreign overlords. And the pressure of all of that has actually created divisions and factions within Judaism. You've got, for example, the Sadducees, who are in control of the temple and all of the temple apparatus. So they, of course, are in control of all the taxes that go in to support the temple and the priests who are ministering there. And so they're wealthy and they're content. Of course, why wouldn't they be? So they're eager to see the Romans just gotten along with. Let's just get along with them. Let's get rid of all of this messianic expectation crap. They throw off the rest of the Old Testament. They just read Torah. None of the rest of it matters. And that enables them sort of theologically to sort of accommodate the Romans and to just let them be in charge. You have the Pharisees, who represent a fledgling school of rabbis or teachers who have inherited this idea of gathering around Torah that first started during the exile. And the Jewish communities gathering around these synagogues would have a rabbi who would just teach them Torah. And so you start having these teachers that debate with one another. And those are sort of like the modern day, even or the Jewish equivalent of an evangelical Protestant. You know, they believe the Bible is the word of God. They want to live faithfully to it. They want to call the people to live faithfully to it. But they're not rabble rousers. They're not out there trying to overthrow the Romans or overthrow even the Sadducees for that matter. You know, they're content to get along with the status quo, not because they're happy about it, but because they're waiting on God to do something about it. So they're very orthodox in their theology, very conservative, but they're not zealots. They're not, you know, insurrectionists, usually. And then you have insurrectionists, zealots, extremists, fundamentalists, who are like, no, unless we purify ourselves completely of all of this pagan stuff, God's never going to bless us with the messianic age. And so you have these groups that withdraw completely from the sort of cities of Judea, including Jerusalem, and they build for themselves these little exclaves out in the desert where they can live lives according to their own rigorous customs and their own reading of the law and the prophets. One of these groups is probably called the Essenes, and that's the group that's probably responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls. This group of Hebrew and Greek translations of Hebrew manuscripts that were discovered in caves in these little clay jars in the 1940s. And these caves were out in the wilderness where the scholars began to discover the remains of their settlements together. So this is a situation at the time Jesus is born. There's a strong desire for national independence as a nation. They've had a brief taste of it, but it didn't quite work out the way they hoped it would. And there's also, and you can imagine why, of extremely deep distrust of outsiders. I mean, they're reading Maccabees in the synagogues along with Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and they've seen what outsiders do. They don't like the Jewish people. They don't like their ways, and they try to get rid of it, try to get it out of the way. And so a birth during this period is a strong Jewish sort of ethnocentric purity that, with the possible exception of the Sadducees, really does infiltrate all of the other major parties of Judaism at this time. And it's understandable why that might be the case. You know, they've been persecuted, they've been hounded. So they don't like outsiders, they're suspicious of them. And of course, they forget about their mandate to bless the nations. And this becomes a problem again and again in Jesus' ministry, and we'll get to that later. The ferment for national independence, they're reading the prophets, you know, on Saturday, Sabbath, and they're hearing about all of God's great promises to bring about a new king under the line of David and restore the nation and to judge the nations and bring them under Israel's heel. And so they're waiting for it. And a people that's been oppressed like that, who has a strong sense of who they are, they have a strong controlling literature the way the Jews did with the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, just their Bible, and all of these unfulfilled promises, it's a powder keg, and all of these warring Jewish groups that have different interpretations of how it's supposed to be, and all of the pagan overlords that try to rule them struggle with how to do it. Some of them are moderately more successful than others, but it's always uneasy, you know, and the Romans aren't a whole lot better at it. You know, you often hear from Sunday schools, you know, lecterns and pulpits that the Romans were these great oppressors, and that's marginally true. I mean, Romans could be brutal when they needed to be. But the Romans, like the Persians, were actually quite pragmatic. And they just knew in order to rule a people, you have to get them to like you. And so let them do what they want to do. Just make them pay taxes and be done with it. And if they don't comply, then you punish them. But if they do, let them be. Just leave them alone. And so the Romans actually were quite pragmatic and, you know, you might say even enlightened in their foreign policy at this time. The Jews didn't like them, And the Romans did much like the Jews, because the Jews didn't appreciate Roman benevolence. You know, they wanted to be independent. They wanted their king. And so you had all kinds of Messiah pretenders rising up at this time. People who claimed, like, hey, I'm the guy. And they'd get these groups of people to follow them. And they'd go out in the wilderness and they'd harass Roman lines and Roman supply lines and Roman forts. And the Romans would come in and just destroy them every time. It's happened several dozen times. There's a couple actual moments that are cited in Gospels and Acts within the living memory of people alive. This guy tried it. It didn't work out very well for him. So there's a lot of people claiming to be the Messiah. You know, I'm him. And they raise up an army, because that's what the Messiah is supposed to do, is deliver us from our enemies, and the Romans trounce them every time, you know, without no exceptions. And so you can see why Jesus might be a little skittish about people like, hey, you're the Messiah. Don't say anything. Because yeah, Jesus, of course, not only his time hasn't come yet, he doesn't want the Romans to start noticing him, but he also has a very different definition of what the Messiah is supposed to do than is prevalent in his day, right? So you see, after he feeds the crowds in John's gospel, it says that Jesus, aware they were about to seize him and make him king by force, withdrew from them. And it's this big secret among scholars. Why was Jesus with the messianic secret? Why didn't he want anybody to know he was the Messiah? And other people have pointed out, well, he only didn't want Jews to know he was the Messiah. When he would travel in Tyre or Sidon or in the Decapolis or pagan areas, Gentile areas, he was quite content to let people know who he was. Because that woman calls him Son of David, the Syrophoenician, we read about her last Sunday. He commends her. Or the healing of the demoniac of Gennesaret, that's in the Decapolis, that's a Gentile area. He says, go and tell everybody all that God has done for you. Right? He's not concerned about them so much. He's concerned about Jews getting the wrong idea about what he's up to, in part because it's just so tense during his day. Everybody's just waiting for God to show up. And I've already walked through the various clans within Judaism that are exacerbating all of this tension. And the last thing I want to mention is that, you know, all of the Jews at this point, like I said, they didn't all go home right away. Only some of them did. And so there are still a lot of Jews living around the Mediterranean world, outside Judaism, outside Judea, outside Palestine. Most of those Jews, you know, they don't speak Hebrew. They might know a smattering of Aramaic, but most of them are, you know, they speak Greek. They haven't lived in Palestine for generations. And so that's just another factor involved in just sort of the situation at the time Jesus arrives. I want to just transition now towards the end of our time together tonight with this observation: we are slaves this day. Going back to Ezra and Nehemiah. What's going on here? What is God doing? I think anybody who's watching at this time, who believes in the law of God, who believes that God is the creator of all and believes he's able to do what he says he's going to do, they're asking this question: what's God up to? You know, when is he going to act? When is he going to save us? And I think it's worthwhile us asking that too. Why did God take all of this time? Right? God promises to bless the nations through Abraham's descendants. We know all the way back to the garden that God's on a mission to liberate humanity from sin and death. Why didn't he just send Jesus to just come and die right away? Like, why bother with this 1,000-year-long interlude with Israel failing miserably and struggling and being smited and judged and wailing and weeping? Why bother? Why would God take the time? Why do you think? Shows his grace. Right. I mean, how else would we know unless we had some historical record of it happening, right? Why else do you think God takes the time? It's an interesting question, because we just sort of, we read the Old Testament, we have it as Christians, it's the Bible, right? So like, we don't think about it, you know, but it's worth asking. Well, why bother? Why wait? Why not just be done with it? You bring the Messiah right away. And I have a theory I'd like to pitch to you tonight. This series is called God Becomes Man. And I think you can understand the history of Israel as a nation and all of the promises God made to them and all of the things that he did with them as the process of God becoming man. We are all products, every one of us, of a complex interaction between our parentage, our culture, our language, the values of the people who live around us, and of course the choices that we make as we get older. We like to think of ourselves as free, autonomous individuals, but if we think about it even just for a moment, I think we discover fairly quickly that we're pretty dependent on the people around us. You know, I mean, we live in a modern society where just about everything that I do and have and understand is the result of other people's work. I mean, I didn't make these clothes. I didn't print and bind this Bible. I didn't make this lectern. Actually, I think somebody in this church made this lectern, but the wood didn't come from here, and who manufactured the stain, and who made the tools that allowed the person to make this? And we're dependent. We depend on one another. And where do I get my mail? Where do I get my water? Where do I get my electricity? You know, we need each other. We don't live as islands. And the culture that's around us forms us, right? The assumptions that we have and the lenses through which we think about things is the product of our forebears who've thought about these things and handed them on to us. We're formed by the cultures around us inexorably. In fact, when human beings are left completely detached from other culture, they don't do anything. There's a remarkable case of a girl that was rescued from her parents' house in California back in the 80s, I think. And her parents never let her out of her room ever. They locked her up in there. And when the authorities found out about this and rescued her, she didn't know how to talk. No one had ever bothered to even talk around her, let alone teach her to talk. And so she didn't actually acquire language. She never learned how to speak. And it was remarkable because scholars had always wanted to know, well, how dependent is our acquisition of language and the way we process our feelings and our thoughts? You know, how much of that's dependent on other people? But they never had a control group, right? Because there wasn't a human being alive who hadn't had those things. So they weren't sure what it would look like. Well, now all of a sudden there's this living person in front of them who had been deprived of all of that, and she was a shell of a human. And over time, they were able to teach her basic language. By the time they found her, she was in her 20s, I think, or in her late teens. And she'd, of course, been seriously, her body was malnourished and her brain was underperforming because it hadn't been stimulated. So she wasn't able to ever be fully rebounded. But interaction with human beings did help her, you know, kind of heal a little bit from that trauma. Why do I talk about all? Why does this matter? Well, according to the Apostle Paul, the Son of God empties himself when he becomes a human being, right? All the things that are proper to God, he sets aside. Did not consider equality with God a thing to be exploited or used to his own advantage. It's a very difficult word to translate there. But emptied himself and became nothing. Became obedient as a servant, being found in human likeness. And so much of the conflict in the early church over the nature of Christ and what he was driven by a strong sense among the church's theologians and clergy that he had to be what we are. Whatever else he was, he had to be a man. And anything that's proper to a man, he had to have had. You know, well, humans have wills. Well, he had a human will then. Well, humans have minds. Well, he had a human mind then. We might now talk about modern categories of the person. You know, humans have a consciousness. Well, he must have had that then. If he didn't have it, he wasn't like us. And all the limitations that are proper to a human being, he had to have had. Otherwise, he wouldn't really be a man. And we know from his earthly ministry, there were times when he didn't know things you would think he would know. Like, it's not the Son's place to know, but only the Father's, about the end times. He had a deep awareness of how people ticked. He had a very intimate relationship with the Father. But the Gospel of Luke is explicit. He grew in wisdom and stature among men and God. You know? And when he was a boy in the temple, he's asking the teachers questions. He impresses them with the quality of his questions and with his answers. But he's learning. He's a human being. He doesn't have omnipotent knowledge. He's not just God in form only, or a man in form only, but in every other respect, his own perception of reality, he sees as God. I don't think that's what our church fathers shed their blood to defend. I don't think that's what the New Testament teaches. Jesus was a man, and God became nothing, emptied himself, is the language Paul uses. So imagine for a moment with me, if you will, if God were to limit himself in all the ways that we are limited, if he were to enter into our world as a human baby to human parents and had to just learn about the world and the ways of the world, entirely the way that human beings learn about it, what that would have been like if God hadn't done anything in the world yet. There's no knowledge of God, right? We've thrown him off. The revelation of God to the human race has been given through the Jewish people. And so he wouldn't have known himself. It's kind of a weird experiment, like sort of mental experiment to think about, because that's, of course, not how it happened. Jesus is born into a nation that has now had 1,000 years, and counting Abraham, even longer than that, of experience wrestling with God. You know, and God has led them to commit these experiences to writing. And so this people, especially having experienced the disasters and troubles that they've experienced as a nation, are deeply aware of who they are and what God has called them to be. And this is the cultural milieu that Jesus is born into. And God chooses for him parents that are very faithful Jews. And we know this from the little bits of details that we get from the Gospels, that they're observant. And they go to Jerusalem on pilgrimages during the high feast of the church or the Jewish year. And they go to synagogue regularly. Jesus goes to the synagogue on Sabbath, as was his custom. Where did he learn that? Obviously from his parents. We know that Mary and Joseph were faithful, devout, believing Jews. And they took the word of God on its face and believed it. And this is the people God chose to raise himself. And if you think, it melts the brain to think about it, but that's the incarnation for you. Start thinking about it for even a half a second, and you can't anymore. It's a complex reality. And so Jesus is born into a people who are deeply aware of God's election on them. And as Jesus reads the Old Testament story, as he reads the prophets, he begins to discern. Certainly he would have heard from his mother about the angelic announcement of his birth. I mean, I can't imagine they kept that from him. He had to have developed a consciousness early in his life that he's not your typical person. He's not your typical man. He is a man, but not your typical man, and that God has great things in store for him. And he begins to see echoes in his own life of Israel's own journey. You know, when Herod finds out about his birth, he slaughters all the babies of Jerusalem. Well, has that ever happened before in Jewish history when all the young boys were killed by the pagan overlord? When did that happen? In Egypt, before the Exodus, right? Before Israel was a nation. And they were just a ragtag group of descendants of Abraham, you know? And then his parents flee to Egypt. And then the evangelist Matthew says, and this is to fulfill what it said, that out of Egypt I have called my son. If you look up that passage in the Old Testament, that's clearly about Israel. It's not describing the Messiah. It's describing the journey that Israel makes as a nation, that God calls them out of slavery in Egypt. And so the evangelists are, well, he's doing what Israel did. He goes down there. You know, he escapes slaughter, and he's delivered, and then he comes out of Egypt. He grows in wisdom. You know, he learns the law, just like Israel had the law at Sinai. He grows in knowledge. He goes to the temple and sees the sacrifices and sees all the symbolism of all of that. He participates in the festivals that mark key moments of Israel's salvation, the Passover and the Feast of Booths and Pentecost and all of these great celebrations. And he begins to internalize that whatever's happened to them is supposed to happen to me. And where does he get that idea? Channel your inner last week. He's getting that from Isaiah, I think, and from other places, that you know, the king to come in the line of David is going to be what Israel is supposed to be, you know, ideal Israel. And what I think is going on here is that all of this is unfolded, in part to be a lesson to us. And this is how the revelation is breaking forth into the world. So I don't want to play that piece down necessarily, because of course we read the Old Testament and are edified by it. Sometimes it's not easy to understand. But I think all of this is for Jesus. I think that this is how he comes to the knowledge of who he is, who Israel is, and what God intends to do through and for them. And he begins to realize, like, this is what I have to do, right? And so when he says to his disciples, we'll talk about this last week, the Messiah must suffer and die. Why? Because Israel did. Israel suffered and died. The nation was destroyed. You know, the first covenant lapsed. It was over. You know, the law of Moses was in abeyance. Jesus intuits that I have to do all this. I have to live this out. And if going back again, this is now from this point forward, it's going to start paying forward all the work we've done till now, and all the Old Testament stories that we've read, and all the symbols and stories, and now they're starting to get leveraged by the New Testament writers, going all the way back to the Exodus. Let's go back even further still, Genesis chapter 1. What's the first thing God does to create? When he goes to create the heavens and the earth, he creates light, and then what does he do after that? This iconic moment that shows up again and again in the biblical story. What does God do? Huh? He names. He does that. That's true. Huh? He talks to himself. Like, hopefully not like one of those like Manhattan homeless men. Definitely not. Definitely not. He divides the waters. Remember how I told you in that ancient Israelite cosmology that the earth exists in this chasm between the waters above and the waters below? And that when the flood waters come in Noah's reign, it says the heavens are open and the floodgates of the deep are open. The waters are coming in from both directions. Because that's how they understand that God has divided water, which is a symbol of chaos, of lack of life. And he's created space between divided waters in order for life to exist. And he reiterates this image with Noah and the flood. Right? How does God make Israel? He leads them through divided waters. And I don't think the author of Exodus was missing it. The Apostle Peter certainly didn't. He directly equates the creation and the waters and Israel's Exodus. Jesus' ministry begins with what? His baptism. He divides the waters, right? I made the case to you way back when we were talking about the Exodus that what's happening with Israel is God is starting anew, right? He gives Israel a mandate to be fruitful and multiply. Who does he give that mandate to before them? To Adam and Eve, right? Our first parents. So Israel is a microcosm of the human race. Israel is the idealized humanity, and God's going to do something great with them. He's going to give them his law, and he's going to show them about his ways. Of course, they blow it, because so does the first man. And when God sends the first man out of the Garden of Eden, where does he send them? Does anybody remember the direction he sends them? East. And where does God send Israel when they fail? East, to Babylon. Literally. It's not just a figure, right? I'll take questions in a second, Tim. Hold that question, though. I want to get to it. Israel is humanity idealized. And the coming Messiah, the servant of Isaiah, is Israel idealized. And if Israel is humanity idealized, and the coming Messiah is going to be Israel idealized, then who is the Messiah? If A equals B and B equals C, then A must equal. Jesus is the new Adam. The second man, the re-beginning of the human race. But unlike Israel, Jesus is not tainted with sin. He's not going to struggle the way they do. And so when Israel goes out into the wilderness after the Exodus, what happens to them? They want meat. They want the flesh pots of Egypt. They're enticed by the world, the flesh, and the devil. And they do what? What do? They worship an idol. They apostatize. Jesus is baptized. He's led through divided waters. What happens to him next? He goes into the wilderness. And what happens to Jesus in the wilderness? He's tempted. And what happens to Jesus when he's tempted? Does he succumb? He defeats the devil. Right? So he's living out what Israel is living out, which is what humanity has lived out. But he's doing it right. He's not failing. He's successful. It is written, thou shalt worship the Lord only, and him only shalt thou serve. He's getting it right. He's doing the journey without falling. And I think that Jesus is getting all of this just from the story. He knows it's going to play out this way. Right? Which is why when the Spirit leads him out in the wilderness, he knows that's where he's supposed to go, because that's where Israel went when they left Egypt. So the beginning of this series I've called God Becomes Man, because I think this is what's going on. I think that this is God preparing the groundwork for his own arrival. And not just in triumph and glory on clouds of thunder, but as one of us. Because the promise of the serpent, the promise of the woman, was that her seed would destroy the serpent, right? It's got to be a man. Man can't do it. We've already seen that. Israel certainly tried. So Jesus is going to do it. He's the seed of the woman. He's the seed of Abraham that's going to bless the nations. He's the seed of Moses that's going to bring forth the law into the world. He's the seed of David that's going to establish God's righteous reign. And we're going to see all of this in the coming weeks. As we walk our way through the life of Jesus, I'm going to focus on how he specifically, in his ministry, and how the evangelists portray him this way, reenacts moments of Israel's history, but does it successfully. Doesn't fail the way they do. He's the new lawgiver, Sermon on the Mount. He's the new Moses, feeds the people in the wilderness, 5,000 of them. That's twice, actually. You know, he's the new David, walks into the city in triumph on a donkey. He's the new lamb that was slain. No one saw that piece coming. Isaiah did. And Jesus saw it too. That's why he understood that he had to suffer and die. So all of this is God becoming man. It's him preparing the groundwork. And we're going to find out in the coming weeks that the reason why God does all of this, becomes like one of us, he takes what is ours so that we can have what is his. He becomes man so that we could become like God. And that's going to be our thesis for the rest of this class. So it's a strange idea, and I want to put it back to you now, guys. What do you guys think of that? Anything about what I said seemed odd or blasphemous? You go ahead and tell me. It'll be live on Facebook for eternity. Everybody will know. Tim, you had a question.
Yeah, I had a couple.
Go for it. Ask. Right, and that's after the Transfiguration, so it's probably a tradition to be believed somewhere in northern Israel.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, that he makes his way to Jerusalem from Jericho. You know, where's Jericho relative to Jerusalem? It's to the east. It's right on the Jordan River.
So I don't know if that, because it seems rather...
That's because of the way English Bibles are laid out. It's the old Greek order, but... So all the histories are just together, right? So you start with Joshua, Judges, Kings in sequence. Chronicles just repeats Kings, and then Ezra and Nehemiah after them. And then all the prophets are grouped together in one group. But Ezra and Nehemiah are actually at the end of the Jewish canon. They do come, yeah. They're separated by the prophets, actually. You get all of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and then all the minor prophets are in the Hebrew Bible before you get to Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles. Yeah. Yeah, Blake, sorry, I didn't see your hand. It was like blending in with the pews. It's like the same color. I have no problem with that analysis.
The order of explanation that runs the other opposite direction.
Yeah, the order from the experience of Jesus, though, would be the order I just gave. That Israel does it first, and then he... But, you know, before the foundation of the world, God sends his son, right? So... I don't have any problem at all with the idea that God guides Israel the way he guides them because he's intent on the life of Jesus, and he wants it to play out that way, right? And he knows this is how he's going to do it, so let's provide the cultural context in which it can happen naturally. Naturally, I mean, as much as the incarnation is natural, right? But through human processes, he's a man, you know? And he learns his Torah the way all Jewish boys learn their Torah, by hearing it read in synagogue and reading it on Papa Joseph's lap. Yeah. Any other questions besides before I get back to Tim? I want to give other people a chance to talk. Yeah, Tim. Go ahead and ask your question now.
do you think there was a moment?
I have no idea. I don't know how we could know. I mean, the evangelists just don't record that. Right. Anybody else have an idea about that?
But I think to get the kind of confidence that you are God, Holy Spirit would have to work in a pretty powerful way to proclaim to you the truth of this truth.
Right.
So I would imagine that he has a slow realization of the scriptures. I mean, at 12, obviously he knows that God is his father.
Yeah.
Because he's got Mary's testimony about the angel, he's studied the scriptures, so he can see this. But surely the Holy Spirit is like living and active in, you know, calling him in the way that he called Samuel, he talked to Moses.
Right.
I mean, he was a man, but I think clearly the Holy Spirit had to be like giving some kind of prophetic, having some kind of prophetic.
Yeah, and to say that Jesus was fully man doesn't require us to deny any of that, because like you just said, that happens to Samuel, Moses. Yeah, Eric. Right. Right. And Luke, when you know when Luke does his genealogy, when Matthew does his genealogy, he stops at Abraham, right? So he's keen to show Jesus as the hope for Israel. When Luke does a genealogy, he goes all the way back to Matthew starts with Abraham, works his way up to Jesus. Luke starts with Jesus and works his way back. He goes past Abraham. He goes all the way to Adam. And the genealogy ends with the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God, right? So the evangelists are definitely reading Jesus' life in these terms. And why are they doing that? Well, I think they get it from Jesus. And we can talk about oral tradition of the Gospels later, but I don't think they're coming up with anything on their own. I think they're just, this is what they heard Jesus teach. Yeah. All right, well, next week we're going to dive a bit more deeply into a more particular area here. We're going to look at Jesus in the New Exodus. And specifically the time in the wilderness and the feeding of the 5,000. So read Mark 6, 30 through 52, and John 6, 22 through 71. Those are both those Gospels' respective accounts of the feeding of the 5,000. And come back next week prepared to talk about it. All right?